corporate personality. An individual is the group, and the group is the individual. And the Jewish thought would have no trouble with this because, see, they all are one. They're living a unity. Blood is life force, okay? Blood is life force. And when a baby is born, it has the blood of its parents. That's all they see. Now, don't think modern medicine. Think primitive thought. A baby comes out of the mother's womb with blood. Where did it get the blood from? It got the blood from the mother. The mother got, as far as they know, the mother and the father slept together, so part of the father's life goes into the mother. Therefore, every child here has life from the same ancestor, from, take it back far enough, from Adam. So we are all in Adam when he sins. We're one with him. We are extensions of Adam. That's all. We're Adam's life force continuing today, so we don't belong in the garden. Now, this is Hebrew mind. I'm not arguing our way. They would never even raise the question of, is this fair? They can't raise the question because they were all present in Adam. What they are doing, therefore, isn't describing or debating the justice of our all suffering because of the sin of another. They're describing for us the reality of our all suffering because of the sins of others. And here's, I want to get to you, I said that for a long time I thought this was ridiculous, that we, what this means in the doctrine of the original sin is that Adam did something and we all suffer. That we suffer the effects of a sin of another. And as I shared with you, I didn't think this important. I was embarrassed by the thought when I did the outline, and I'm embarrassed today that I didn't see how crucial it is. I carry around two pains. The pain of my own sin and the pain of the sin of others. And to miss either is not to understand it. When an alcoholic tries to stop drinking and tries to live sober, one of the things they're recommended to do is in writing to write out their whole life. And then to go to someone and share everything they have ever done wrong. A lot of alcoholics have asked me for advice on this, and when they come to me to share, because they've known I've had a problem, it's sort of a confession that is no confession. There's no sacrament or anything. They just tell it all to me and say they admit to God, to themselves, and to another person, and that'd be me, everything they've ever done wrong. When I take them through this, what they have written, mainly, because this is all they were told, is a record of their own sin. When they talk to me about it, what I take them through equally is a whole record of all of the hurt they have ever suffered. You see, most of the sinning that I have done flowed from the effects of the sin of others on my life, mainly my parents. My parents chose a lesser love. Because of this, they did not have all the love to give me that I needed. And therefore, before I was ever free, already there are hurts coming into my life. I needed to be fed. I needed to be, you know, to really gain security. But my mom and my dad could have a fight. I could be a year old. I could be 6 months old. My mother and my dad could have had a fight. My mother could have been nervous. She picks me up, and that tension is communicated to me. And inside me, all I can feel is I'm not getting satisfaction. I feel tension coming in. I can't understand why. And then when I'm between the ages of 1 and 2, I'm trying to explain this, but it's real. You know, between the ages of 1 and 2, I start seeing that there are things I do that make my parents angry, that take love away. And then when I am punished, I get love back. I mean, you know, I knock over a vase. My mother slaps me, after she slaps me and I cry some, then she loves me again. So I do something wrong, love is taken away. I am punished, love comes back. And that sets up in some ways the sickest set of thinking possible. So you have sin, love goes, and we put this on God because the only standard we have for understanding how God acts is our parents. We've never seen what God does to you. So you see what your parents have done. Love goes, there's punishment, love returns. Love goes. You're 3 years old and all of a sudden love goes. Your mother dies in a car accident. The greatest authority on death in the United States, a fabulous woman that I'm aware of, a brilliant psychiatrist, Dr. Kubler-Ross, in her book on death and dying says, I forget the age, I think it's 12, but it certainly is 3 and 5. The child can only take the blame for the death. Because there's nothing else. Up until now, you've got to take the blame. Love goes, who's responsible? You know, the pattern's been learned. I know that there were things I did. My mother was, well, insistent that I be toilet trained by a certain day. So, you know, she got me up in the morning, the diapers were wet, love went in a hurry. And pain came, and then maybe love came back. Okay, a pattern's being learned. Now, when that same pattern is there, the love goes, all I can feel is I've done it. I'm to blame. I've done something wrong. Just now, take this pattern. My mother feels down, which means she isn't capable of loving me. I feel guilt. What have I done? It's that nameless thing. What have I done to cause this? And I'm looking for some kind of punishment. Boy, if I could only get that punishment, then the love will come back. And we set up unconsciously to punish ourselves often. So I'm being scarred because my parents weren't perfect. Why? Because they didn't get perfect love from their parents. Okay? 100% love our parents are supposed to give us. They're part of the way love comes into us. When I'm 1 year old, I couldn't feel God loving me, but I could feel my parents loving me. That balloon getting inflated. I needed 100%. They, because of their sin, only gave me 90%. So the year isn't developing on me. Now, if I have children, just to show how this spreads, I don't even have 100% to start out with. I start off with 90. And because I sin, I lower the amount, so all I can blow into my children is 80. And evil spreads this way. And it's real. They're the very real scars. These, if you want to see my understanding, and it isn't a very neat thing, I feel guilt and shame mainly from my sin. Fear mainly from the sin of others. The scars that they have brought into my life. And unless you see, I feel sorry for people who have no doctrine of original sin. No understanding how another person's sin and the sin of society. Society doesn't accept me the way I want. Society tells me I shouldn't be certain things that I am. Alcoholism is a shameful disease. Most people don't want me to be an alcoholic. God created me this way. From all eternity, He knew I'd be an alcoholic. He knew that this would be how I would find His peace. He doesn't want me to be drunk today. But by accepting the fact that I have the disease of alcoholism, I come to accept the person that I am and to enable Him to love me. There are socially unpopular diseases and conditions. There are socially unpopular sexual drives that urges that almost every one of us have. We feel that nobody else in the world ever has them. We hate ourselves for them. We repress them. Why? Because all these patterns of rejection have been put in. Society wasn't able to give us perfect love because of its sin. The corporate consequences of sin. And boy, if you don't understand original sin, you ain't going to understand how to face the world. You'll go before God, you'll know that your sin's forgiven, and yet you're still screwed up. Why? Paul says it. Paul, in one sense, missed it when he says, the evil that I do, that I don't want to do, I find myself doing. Why so very often? Because I'm still scarred. I'm flustered. I'm bent on an angle instead of being able to stand upright on my own two legs. The effects of the sin of others have made me stand on an angle. So unless God has my hand, I'm going to fall before I've done anything. And so I do fall and get scarred some more. It's a very real thing in living. We aren't in the Garden of Eden. The effects of our parents' sin has removed us from that ideal circumstance, and we don't have perfect parents. Now you'll be ready to understand, maybe. I'll bring in the first of the ideas of Mary, the Immaculate Conception. Mary is spared original sin. Okay? That's what that means. That Mary does not feel the effects of the original sin. The big word. This is one of the things that Catholics alone, or not Catholics alone, Catholics, Orthodox, and maybe some High Anglicans. This isn't on the outline either. This is a totally unique Catholic idea, the Immaculate Conception. You know what it means? It means that in one womb, God wanted love to be heard completely. In one heart, God wanted love to be heard from the very beginning. So he spoke his love that clearly inside Mary while she's still in her mother's womb to protect her. That Mary was spared the results of the sin of her parents. So through her whole existence, she could hear the word of love that was being spoken to her. So real that that word would become part of her flesh, completely a part of her. Because it is through her that the word must become flesh. And if Mary wasn't immaculately conceived, Jesus would have been handicapped. Because the word wouldn't have been heard completely. And she couldn't give full flesh to the word. Jesus would have been born without an ear being popped up, okay? Mary had to be protected in a special way from the effects of the sin of her mother. Because so the love of that Jesus is flows into her from the moment of conception so that she doesn't feel the consequences of the human error of her parents, whom tradition says, we don't know who her parents are at all. Tradition says they are Anne and Joachim. But that's nowhere in the scripture. Well, one of them is. The other one isn't. Mary is ever an image of the church. Now, this is what we've always got to do. Remember, we're not ever, we said this in the first class, we preach Christ, Jesus Christ. And if we ever end up with Mary alone, boy, we're in trouble. We're distracting from Jesus. Mary we look at because she offered Jesus to the world. What's our job today? To offer Jesus to the world. Mary is ever an image of what we are supposed to be. Because of Jesus, she was spared the consequences of the sin of others. The church, God's people, has its Immaculate Conception. That's Pentecost. As the people of God, the body of Christ, we're sinless. And we have been immaculately conceived. We have been absolutely spared from the results of the sin of our parents. Because we have received the fullness of the love of the Spirit of God, washing away all the effects of our parents' sin. The church, as the spirit of love alive in us, is immaculate. At the same time, we are full from human flesh. And we have our choice to live the results of our original sin if we're living our own human weakness. If we just become ourselves, if we live as the body of Christ, we, the church, have an immaculate conception because we've got to hear this same word of love and offer it to the world as really as Mary did. Not in one person as Mary did, but we've got to offer exactly the same Jesus in flesh now. So we have our true immaculate conception. That's Pentecost. The church is born from above. The church is immaculate. Now, the fact that God used people who had human flesh and all sorts of weakness to do it, that's great. That sets up this fabulous tension. Yes, we're still imperfect, and yet we can celebrate our sanctity. Yes, we are sinners. Sinners in our own right, and sinners, those who are the result of the sin of others. And yet at the same time, we're saints. Paul never forgets it in his writing. If you're not immaculate and haven't been, how could you be a saint? Paul writes to the Christians, to the saints in the church of, to the saints in the church of, to the saints in the church of. And if he were calling us, he wouldn't, you know, writing to us, he wouldn't say to the tomorrow saints. He'd say to the saints in the people of God assembling in Enid. Now, how can we be saints? Because we're immaculately conceived. How are we immaculately conceived? Because the Spirit of Jesus conceives us. The Spirit of Jesus pushes aside as a reality, when God looks at us, all of our own sin and the sin of others. We can live that immaculate conception. We can learn a freedom from the sins of others as well as our own. We can ever take the word of love and broaden it to change our past. Jesus can do this. He can free me from my yesterday and from the scars of, he can heal me from the scars of others. And I've seen that done just so fabulously. He certainly wants to. See, those who deny original sin will just ask for forgiveness from their own sin. Those who accept original sin will come to Jesus to be healed from the sins of others. And I need that. I need that very badly. I need that Jesus heal the scars of the way my parents hurt me, the way teachers hurt me, the way friends hurt me. I'm afraid to make friends because I had so much insecurity as a youth that I made very few friends, and they would do something that would give me the feeling they didn't like me, and that would terrifically cut me. And I can't expose myself to be cut easily this way. So my tendency, because of continuing original sin, this isn't just something that happens the moment I'm born, continuing original sin in my life is not to want to be scarred. Well, that's sensible. But it doesn't make for a happy life. So what I've got to do is open myself up to the love of Jesus. Let him wash away this hurt, and I can go out and offer myself in friendship. This can be healed. They're not always forever healings. They're day-by-day healings. His love comes in. It's a contingent healing again and again. A little bit different from the other kind of forgiveness where my past is completely forgiven. My present can only be changed if I'm open to the love that Jesus is. If I live my Pentecost rather than my first birth. I was born outside of Eden, or I was born at Pentecost. And I can be either one by my choice. If I live my Pentecost, I can be immaculate. I can come to you with love to offer you, free of my yesterday. If I live my birth outside of Eden, evil, selfishness, fear, insecurity are just pulling me in and in and in. And my life had reached the point where I spent 9 months living on alcohol and pills locked in my room. I couldn't face anybody. I know what it means to be powerless over evil. And we're not getting la-di-da's here. We're getting very real things. You know, this is a description of how the world is. I may not like it, but that doesn't make any difference. We're learning how the world is, and therefore we begin to see how much we need Jesus. For he, and he alone, is the answer. So, just what I was just saying, Genesis 1 to 11, therefore, are far more than a history of yesteryear. They're a teaching of today. And we've summarized pretty much that there's one God who's good, who makes you good, and who makes everything else also good. You were made to need community and to use the universe, to work it for your good and everybody else's. We are all equal in our need for each other. Evil is the result of our misuse of freedom.
and the misuse, it's also the result of the misuse of the freedom of others affecting our life. Once it enters our world, we're powerless over it. But God doesn't ignore us, and His power can and does handle it. And that gets us ready then for the second part of the Pentateuch, starting with chapter 12, the great moment of Abraham. When we cross, I don't agree with everything that is in the outline again. I made it a little bit stronger than I would really say it. When you start reading chapter 12, you're reading a whole different world. Now there is history underlying. If you were here last time, you'll understand these statements. If you get shocked, please borrow the tape from next time. If you've heard me correctly, these first 11 chapters are an attempt of a very brilliant editor using very great stories to explain to you the world in which you're living and God who's relating to you in this world. He's teaching you the real reality. Far more real than the fact that we have 50 states is the fact that there is a good God who is making you and you at this moment. Far more real than your income tax and more important than your government is the fact that you're powerless over evil. You can't do anything to undo that insecurity. You need to be saved. Most people don't believe those. They're unreal to them. And so we have a civilization that's falling apart. We have a civilization that's becoming ever more material, ever more living for just sexual pleasure, ever more needing to escape, and ever more mentally ill. Every statistic that I'm aware of shows this, that mental illness is increasing rather than decreasing, and the reliance on drugs and alcohol just to escape living, not just to add pleasure, but as basic ways of escape is increasing also. So we're powerless over evil, and these chapters are telling us something. But with Abraham, you read something very, very different now. Oh, if you follow this then, the history, the historical, the facts aren't important. Any of them. I don't believe that there is a fact in chapters 1 to 11. The truths are... That's what's important, the truth. These are stories, they're sort of parables to teach truths that are most real, but the facts of the stories aren't. Just the way that the editor could put two creation stories, one right after another, and the facts contradicting it didn't upset him because he didn't intend you to believe the facts. He expected you to understand the truth, to be open to God touching you and seeing what was happening. So I don't believe there was a universal flood, and I have no problem. I don't believe there was a Tower of Babel. The Bible itself, incidentally, has everybody speaking about 10 or 15 different languages a whole chapter before the story of the Tower of Babel. And the editor could see this. Why didn't he just reverse it? Because that wasn't an important point there. Evil spreading still is. So I don't believe in the Adam and Eve story that the first sin occurred the way it was. I don't believe the Cain and Abel story. I believe the reality of these truths. I've lived them. You may not have. I know that it isn't, you know, we're not getting ideas here. There's nothing in the first 11 chapters of Genesis that I've shared with you that I haven't experienced as a need, as a reality, the ultimate reality of living. Then we hit chapter 12, and it all changes, and here's something now. There's a guy named Abraham, and God comes into his, well, his name is, here's one of these name changes. His name is Abram, which means high father. Not high dad, but tall, high, mighty, mighty father. And God will change his name to Abraham, father of a multitude. And when God changes the name, it's like Adam naming the animals. When God changed his name, there was no way he wasn't going to be father of a whole nation of people. That's the way the Bible would present this. There's a man named Abram who's living in a pagan culture, and God comes into him and he asks him to leave everything that he knows and to set off into the unknown, and that God will guide him and that God will make him the father of a multitude of nations. Abram believes God.
even though he's way up in age and has had no children yet, he's 80-some years old, he leaves the home of his parents, he leaves his culture, he leaves his class. And this is the beginning of God starting to guide man to really experience him direct. The most important thing here almost in this whole story for us, before we get any further, is God actually enters our history and touches someone in our history. And this is part of the story of salvation. God is actually entering your story. That's what, if I just hope somehow you can open up and let break into you today. God enters history, his story, the story of mankind. That's to let you know that, you know, he isn't up in heaven. He is entering. He's breaking into. He is the dynamic reality. He wants to be of your life, your story at this moment. And he's asking you to do exactly the same thing that Abram did. To leave what you know and venture out into the unknown. Now, what do you know? You know self. That's what I know. I know me. I know how to take. I know how to play games. I know how to protect me. I know my fears. What don't I know? The other that I'm dealing with in any moment. What does God ask me to do? He asks me to die to self, to venture out into the unknown, venture out into areas I've never been, and to relate with you. To actually try to feel your feelings, to forget the impression I'm making on you, and to really try to listen to what you're saying so I can feel your feelings. Hear your hurts. Touch your joys. We don't do this at all. My famous example, because it's so real, let me come up to you and say, boy, I had a terrible night last night. I have a strange pain here. And your answer, I'm sure, is going to be, isn't that funny? My knee's been acting up. You know, I've come up to you with a hurt. What do? You bring it into your own frame of reference. The best example, you know, this is what Jesus asks us to do. To die to self, to live for others. To die to self is the big thing so that we may live with Christ. And people say, how do you die to self? You just forget yourself. You just don't think of you and think of someone else. A fabulous example to show you how hard it is, we have no idea how hard it is to talk to someone and not change their conversation. Just don't. The next person who starts talking to you about something, don't change the conversation, their conversation at all. Just ask questions until you really know, real questions, what they're feeling. No reference to what you feel at all or to anything else. It'll drive you crazy. I'm sure you can't do it without a lot of training. This is terrible. I know me, see. And I can hide me and I can play games and I know how to do this. But to really go out and wonder about you, to be concerned about, are you understanding this? Are they really getting it? Not are they really liking me, but are they really kind of, am I open to the love of Jesus to flow through so that that love can use me just to touch him? Oh, that's not natural. And it wasn't natural for Abram. The Bible uses him as the great example of faith. He had to believe in God when he made this journey from the known to the unknown. Going out in the darkness, in a sense. You can't just do that. He's a very real person. As far as we can tell, reading the Bible carefully, Abraham does not believe that there is one and only one God. God starts entering his life. His people grew up with a whole host of gods. He made the God who called him the chief God. Now, reading the Bible carefully, that's what we're finding today. But that's okay. God took him where he was and starts leading him forward. That's the first real step. God doesn't expect you to understand everything about him when he starts touching your life. You've got a lot of ideas. You know, when he comes into your life, there's a host of little gods you're going to have. Things that are still important. I still got lots of them. As necessary, he'll lead you forward in love. Did I witness to the smoking to you last time?
I almost was ashamed because I wasn't trusting God's power enough. I want to show this. There's loads of little things we have, our little gods. They'll come back again when we talk about purgatory way down the line. They'll be a reference. When God's ready, he'll tell us that these gods aren't necessary in our life, these little lords that we serve. I smoked for years, smoked from the time I was 19. So I smoked for 20 years, and I was up to nearly 3 packs a day. I've received 2 weeks ago, my God has a terrible sense of humor. He gets to be a little bit sadistic. 2 weeks ago, I got 3 fabulous lighters that I was looking for, all within a period of a week. From people or groups that I very much value, celebrating the fact, I'll just tell you, that I hadn't had a drink or a pill for 5 years. They're all inscribed to this effect. Oh, and I just got the third of the lighters, the last I was going to get. Got it down in Lawton, was driving back. Smoked all the way to Chickasha, stopped there,